Good morning, everyone, and welcome along to this latest Fraser Valander webinar. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Graham Roy from the Fraser Valander, and I'll be chairing today's session. And it's great to have so many of you joining us. Can I begin by saying that I hope you and your friends and family are all safe and well at these extraordinary times. Now, today's webinar is a joint event with our friends at the Resolution Foundation. As you know, the Resolution Foundation is a think tank focused on research aimed at improving living standards of those in low to middle incomes. And that twin pillar approach of rigour and purpose, not to mention the excellent people that they have working for the organisation, has helped to propel them to become one of the most trusted and respected authorities on the UK economy and economic, fiscal and social policy. And you'll no doubt have seen the excellent work the team has been doing through the COVID-19 crisis, helping to shape the debate and the policy response. We're absolutely delighted that you've joined us today, and you'll be hearing from Cara Pacitti and Richard Hughes. You also hear from Mary Spowage and David Iser from the Fraser Valander. We'll hear first of all from Cara, who will give us an overview of some of the recent work they've done looking at the implications of COVID-19 for the UK economy and the public finances, before hearing from Richard about the policy response and where policy might go next. We'll then hear from Mary, who will give us an update on the Scottish side of things, before David will round off with his thoughts about the potential implications for the Scottish budget. Now, our aim is to try and keep that to about 40 minutes or so, and then we'll open up to questions. To talk you through the technical aspects of how this will work, I'll hand over to my colleague, James Black, who will talk us through the format. Over to you, James.
Hi, everyone. So there's just a couple of things. So at the bottom of your screen, there's a chat function where you can chat to myself and I'll be able to provide any technical assistance. There's also a Q&A function, which we'll be using for the Q&A section, where you can type in your question and we'll be able to see it for later. So that's it, so I'll hand back to Graham.
Great, thanks, James. Now, the nature of the format is that for security reasons, we've had to limit who can see the various questions and engagement from individuals joining us today, but I'll do my best to share these thoughts back with the wider audience when we get to the Q&A, and you'll see the questions that we're answering. And just for information, we'll be putting the slides and the recording of the webinar online later on. So without further ado, if I can hand over to Cara, who will kick us off.
Great, thanks Graham. So as Graham mentioned, I'm going to start by giving you a quick run through of some recent work we did at the Resolution Foundation looking at three potential scenarios for the economic and fiscal impact of coronavirus. So on the next slide, we've got a few of our key assumptions here. So moving on to the next slide, we've got a lot of the work was based on analysis of previous pandemics. Obviously a pandemic's a very specific type of economic shock. So we've based it looking back at the impact of epidemics like SARS, Ebola, the 1918 Spanish flu. And with this in mind, we've come up with three scenarios. There's still a lot of uncertainty around whether we're gonna see kind of opening the economy and when that's gonna be happening. So we've modeled a 3-month, 6-month and 12-month scenario here. And as you can see, in terms of what these actually look like, this is annual real GDP growth. We've assumed a 10% fall in GDP growth in the 3-month scenario, a 20% fall in the 6-month scenario, and a 24% fall in the 12-month scenario. And these are based off of looking back at previous pandemics. We found that economic output during a lockdown generally falls by about a third. And that's also consistent with what we're starting to see in when we're starting to get some more information from business surveys about how companies are actually experiencing the lockdown that we're seeing at the moment. Also interesting here is these black dots on the chart are the Office for Budget Responsibilities 3-month scenario, which as you can see is relatively close to our 3-month scenario, but slightly more pessimistic in 2020. So they're about minus 12.8%, but a lot more optimistic in 2021. And that, if we move on to the next slide, that's one key difference between our scenario and their one. So they assume no long-term hits to the economy, no scarring on the economy. Whereas we've actually assumed, looking back at previous pandemics, this lost output is actually never recovered. So we're modelling here a long-run GDP loss relative to pre-crisis trends, about 3% in the three-month scenario, 5% in the six-month scenario, and 7% in the 12-month scenario, which is around what we expect to see in your average recession. So what's this do to public finances? Well, I think in the next slide, you can see there's two main effects. So one of those is falling revenues. So this light blue bar here is the effect on income tax and national insurance contributions. And we see those fall as a result of lower incomes and less employment. But the other side of this is we also see higher spending pushing up on government borrowing. And that's the yellow bar here, which we'd expect to see as a result of more people claiming, say, job seekers allowance. So this is around about half the story. This is just the impact on government borrowing of the purely the economic shock of lockdown. But as we're also aware, the government has also come out with unprecedented policy support, which is very welcome, but it also pushes up further on borrowing and the pressures on the public finances. So moving forward a slide, and another one. This shows the impact of both the economic scenario that I've mentioned, so that's this red bar here, but also then the costs layered on top of the government's interventions. And you can see that those really start in the economic effects in, say, the 12-month scenario. In particular, you can see some of the more expensive and some of the most significant policy interventions we've seen are things like the coronavirus job retention scheme, the JRS, and also the government loan schemes, so CBILS or CL bills here. And we can really see those costs ramping up. I guess quite intuitive why in terms of loans, you're seeing not just more companies needing loans, but also higher default rates over longer scenarios, we're assuming. So in terms of the overall picture, on the next slide, this is the impact on government borrowing as a percentage of GDP. And what we see is that borrowing peaks in this year at around 11% in a three-month scenario. So that's already higher than the peak during the financial crisis of 10.2%. Peaking at 22% in the six-month scenario, that's around levels we've not seen since World War II. And 38% in the 12-month scenario, which would be unprecedented and around 10 percentage points higher than the highest ever recorded borrowing, which was in 1916-17. So these are real short-term pressures on the government's ability to borrow. And this is, I think, one of the kind of important pressures in public finances is this near-term pressure of being able to borrow this amount of money in this year. Moving on to kind of but more longer term pressures, it obviously has a big effect on debt stocks. So this is the impact on public sector net debt, which peaks at 106% of GDP in 2020-21 in the three-month scenario, which is far higher than during the financial crisis where debt peaked at 83%. And then the six-month and 12-month scenario, we're seeing debt at 129 and 167% of GDP. Which we've not seen since the decade after World War II. Also important here, you can see the dashed lines show excluding the impact of the Bank of England measures. The Bank of England's schemes, like their term funding scheme, are also adding significantly to debt. But what does this actually mean for the government? So the next slide is potentially quite surprising. What we see is that despite the fact we've got significantly increased debt stocks, the cost of servicing that debt actually falls in all of our scenarios as a result of falling interest rates and low inflation. The actual cost of the debt appears relatively cheap, which means at the moment that debt burden looks relatively sustainable, which is good news for the government in the longer term. But it does mean that these higher stocks mean we're more vulnerable to interest rate changes or inflation shocks in the future. And that's what these diamonds show towards the right side of the chart, which would be if interest rates returned to the Bank of England's estimate of equilibrium, which is around 2.25%, as opposed to currently at around 0.4%. And then you see, you start this ratio, sorry, I should have mentioned, is the cost of government's debt interest as proportion of government revenue. And this was a target, keeping this below 6% was a target set out in the 2019 manifesto. Currently, even with higher debt stocks, that looks achievable, but as soon as interest rates or we see an inflation shock rises, and that starts to look a lot more difficult for the government. So I think main takeaways there is like a near-term pressure in the short term in terms of just this increased borrowing in this year, so the cost of financing that and finding that in the markets, but also a longer-term pressure given that we're now a lot more reliant on a low interest rate environment. And I'm now going to pass on to Richard to talk a bit about the policy implications of all of this.
Great. Thanks, Cara. And so against the background of the scenarios that Cara presented for the economy and public finances, I wanted to offer a few reflections on what it means for where we go next in terms of the government's policy response. As Cara was talking about, we've already seen a very aggressive policy response from the government, unprecedented fiscal measures being taken to support firms and individuals. But we are in a crisis that is evolving. And so maybe I'll start off first by just talking about the current context in which government is making policy. And one thing that seems to be becoming increasingly clear is that some sort of social distancing measures are likely to be required at least until the end of 2020. Those are the words of the government's deputy chief medical officer a few weeks ago. And so it does look as though policy needs to be prepared for a lockdown scenario which lasts longer than just the 3 months, which has been the basis for the more optimistic scenarios that we've modeled, as well as some of the official forecasts that you've seen recently. And government does need to be prepared for social distancing to last for possibly 6, even 12 months if a vaccine and reliable testing and tracing regimes can't be developed quickly. And what that means in terms of how you manage the impact on the economy is that it implies that activity in some sectors is likely to be impaired for an extended period. You can see on the right-hand side what the OBR is assuming about the impact of the lockdown measures on different sectors of the economy, and it is very, very differentiated. Some sectors have lost almost their entire level of activity, accommodation, restaurants, some areas of retail have seen big losses in economic activity as a result of social distancing. It's looking increasingly unlikely that that's going to be reversed in its entirety within a matter of months. And some of these sectors are going to be operating below capacity for extended periods of time. While others may recover quickly, those where you can actually work from home more easily, where social distancing is easier to actually implement. But what that means is that there is a risk that the policies that were introduced in the immediate wake of the outbreak, which were right for the rescue phase of the crisis, can actually inhibit the recovery phase of the crisis. And I'll talk a bit about what that means in more detail in a second. But I think another thing which comes out of the modeling that Cara presented is that the pressures on government finances are large, but they actually do look manageable in the near term and even in the longer term. The government is actually not struggling to finance that huge deficit you saw so far. Yields on government debt remain very low. Government debt auctions are going well. And as you saw over the medium term, because interest rates have also fallen in the wake of the outbreak, the longer term burden that debt poses on the public finances actually doesn't look very different from the burden that the government's been having to manage in the period leading up to the crisis. So government's got some fiscal space to innovate if it needs to, in order to not just support the rescue of the economy, but actually help fund the recovery. So if I could have the next slide. The next slide, Mary. Thank you. And so one key policy challenge facing governments, and maybe the biggest policy challenge of this crisis, is how do you stop the temporary furloughing of workers actually becoming longer-term permanent structural unemployment? And the government has clearly obviously been thinking about that recently. And you can see from the right-hand side that depending on what kind of scenario we're looking at for the duration of social distancing measures, you can see very different impacts on longer-term prospect for unemployment. If you are just in a three-month sort of short, sharp shock scenario, you would expect lots of workers to come onto the job retention scheme, but actually then go back to their previous employers in their previous sectors, and for the impact on long-term unemployment to be relatively limited. However, once you start looking at social distancing measures being in place for 6 months or even 12 months, it looks increasingly unlikely that workers are going to be going back to their previous firms or back to their previous sectors, and could end up spending extended periods in unemployment looking for work, and with potential impacts for scarring on the labor force. And so we do think that there's a case for looking again at the coronavirus job retention scheme. The government's already introduced some flexibilities in recent weeks to allow people who are on the furlough scheme to work part-time for their existing employer. But I think one of the issues that comes out of the fact that you're going to see some sectors recovering faster than others is that CGRS support is still being provided through the firm. And there's a risk that if there are firms that are essentially sort of zombie firms sitting in unprofitable sectors where employment levels are never going to recover to their pre-outbreak levels, the CGRS could be trapping workers in those sectors rather than allowing them to move from sectors where activity levels are suppressed to sectors where activity levels are recovering. And so we do think there's a need to look at the portability of CGRS support so that it can follow the workers from declining to recovering sectors. And we also think that up until now, employers haven't been contributing to the cost of furloughing. The 80% salary replacement is entirely covered by government. We think there is a case for those employers that are profitable to actually start contributing to CGRS costs, to actually incentivize them to take their employees off the furlough scheme and put them back into back into productive activity and get them back in the habit of being in the workforce. And if I could have the next slide. A second challenge the government's facing is the fact that how to ensure that the government guaranteed loans, that the C-bills that Cara was talking about, actually can help facilitate businesses adapting their business models to what looks like a new sort of temporary normal environment in which social distancing measures may need to be in place for some time. The C-bill scheme, and as you can see from the right-hand side, you've seen about £6 billion worth of take-up of these schemes. We think that's around 10% actually of our initial estimate of what we thought was going to be take-up of these kind of government guaranteed loans. They don't seem to be as popular as the government was expecting, and they're not as popular as they seem to be in other countries. And that suggests that there is a certain amount of debt aversion on the part of firms to take on government guaranteed loans at a time when their cash flow is constrained. And the C-bill scheme was designed to really help firms deal with a temporary loss of cash flow associated with a relatively brief lockdown. But if we think the social distancing measures are again going to be in place for longer periods, there's an increasing risk that that lost output isn't recovered, and this debt just starts to become a drag on firms' recovery rather than something which actually facilitates their resumption of business. So we think there is a case for, because government can be patient, it doesn't need to be repaid immediately, that actually C-bill repayments should be capped at a certain proportion of firms' turnover. So they never have to pay back more of that loan than a certain share of their turnover as it recovers. And loan repayments don't become a burden on the firm's recovery. And we also think that there is a case for looking at whether some elements of CBIL loans can actually be turned into grants if that money is used by businesses to adapt their businesses, to adapt their workplaces, to allow them to safely resume some kind of activity and write off those loans to actually incentivize firms to use the principal on it to get themselves back into business and get employment going again. And a third challenge, and this is looking from the kind of rescue phase through to the recovery phase, is what can government do to actually try and kickstart that economic recovery and try and get demand going again? So far, we've talked about what we can do to keep the supply side of the economy recovering and healthy. We also need to think about how we can get consumers back into shops and spending money again. And a real challenge in this area is the fact that what we've seen in the wake of the crisis is a really big increase in savings levels. You can see on the right-hand side, sort of tripling of household savings and corporate savings in the wake of the lockdown. That's partly reflecting a higher precautionary savings motive. People are uncertain about the future, so they put aside more money for risk, but also the fact that it's put artificially, people just can't spend money at the moment. The shops are closed, so they can't spend their salaries. That's going to be a barrier to getting the economy going again, and also a barrier to getting traditional sort of broad-based demand stimulus measures to work, like mailing checks to every household. There's a good likelihood that people will just save that additional income. So we think that there is a case for being more innovative in the way we think about stimulating demand. It's interesting, in China, they've experimented with sending consumers sort of exploding vouchers, which have a deadline, which if they're not spent in shops by a certain date, the money disappears. And it's a way of trying to encourage people to actually spend money and get out there and get the economy going again. We also think that there is a window of opportunity in as social distancing measures are lifted, to actually do some kind of safe infrastructure investment. There are not many cars on the road at the moment, not many trains running on the railways. This is an actual opportunity to get that infrastructure upgraded, and so it is in better shape for when the economy is actually moving and operating at closer to capacity. And so with that, I'll hand over to Mary to talk about the implications for the Scottish economy.
Thanks very much, Richard. Yes, I'm going to focus a bit on what we know about the impact on the Scottish economy. We did a piece of work similar to the OBR scenario, looking at what the impact may be on the economy of a three-month shutdown, given the parts of the economy that were mothballed. And we came up with an estimate of around, you know, perhaps around a quarter of output would be lost during this period. And, you know, a similar ballpark to others like the OBR and the Scottish Government, where you're talking essentially that it's a very big number, it's a very big part of the economy that's going to be lost in this period, given the scale of the shutdown. That's the thing to take away from the numbers, really, not the specific point estimate, but rather that it's a really unprecedented and large hit to the economy in the short term. Sectoral effects are likely to be variable, and we've been looking at quite a lot of detail about the different sectors that are impacted. Particularly social and hospitality spending are particularly badly impacted. They were impacted probably first, and in addition are likely to be impacted for the longest period of time. Non-food traditional retail is also in bother, and this is likely to have long-term effects. This is a sector already in quite a lot of difficulty, and it's likely to expedite the changes in the sector, where those who have a innovative online offering are likely to come out better out of this crisis. The oil and gas sector has been particularly affected, given the low oil price and the massive slump in demand that we're seeing for their products. And obviously this has a particular impact on Scotland and the northeast of Scotland specifically. So this is an area which could affect the Scottish economy much more than the UK as a whole. Obviously, large parts of transport have seen demand completely collapse in terms of passenger numbers on rail and bus routes, for example. And construction has had a big impact in terms of sites being shut down. We've estimated anywhere between sort of 40 to 60% of output was mothballed. Some estimates are even higher, up to sort of 70, 80%. And one of the interesting features of the lockdown has been that the approach in Scotland has been a little bit different here. It's much more likely that construction sites were told to stop operating in Scotland if they weren't seen as essential than it happened in the rest of the UK. So all of these sort of sectoral impacts being different will lead to different regional impacts, given obviously certain sectors are more prevalent in different parts of Scotland and the UK. And as I said, that might lead to a different impact in Scotland compared to the rest of the UK, which has other implications, which we'll touch on in a bit. So what do the latest indicators tell us about the impact on the Scottish economy? Obviously, the labour market data were out this morning at 7 a.m. That data only covers up to the end of March, so really only covers about a week of lockdown. There is a rise in unemployment, but very marginal at the moment. But most people are expecting that figure will rise in the coming months, potentially up as high as 10%, so which is the highest level of unemployment that we've seen since the early 1990s. But the official stats are taking a while to come out, obviously, as they do, because they're looking back. But there are lots of new indicators that are being published by people like the ONS about the impact on the economy. For example, this is the Business Impact of Coronavirus Survey, which provides breakdowns for Scotland. And it gives us an idea of the sorts of decreases in turnover that businesses that are continuing to trade are seeing. And you can see that around half of businesses are seeing their turnover decreased by more than half, or at least more than a fifth, which is quite a significant hit to their turnover. So Richard's covered a lot about the policy response and the potential impacts of the policy response in the medium to long term. Obviously these initial responses were designed to help businesses and individuals kind of survive through this mothballing period, so they were in the best shape possible to support economic recovery once we get out the other side of this. The word's been used a lot, but it is unprecedented support by the government for the economy. The interesting thing about it is it's been evolving as certain groups aren't covered by certain policy measures and new measures come along to try and plug those gaps to stop people falling through the cracks. The Scottish policy response has been different in some ways, but it is evolving all the time. So as soon as there's a gap that's pointed out between the rest of the UK and Scotland, sometimes the government have moved to fill that gap, or sometimes they've said, well, there's a good reason for that and this is why we've chosen to do it in a different way. The business rates, holidays and grants are different here. It is a different system, it is a devolved system, so the circumstances were different in the first place. So it wasn't like you could just do exactly the same as you did in the rest of the UK. But there is a different approach here in terms of multiple properties, for example. The rates paid at a different at 75% in Scotland as opposed to 100%. So these grants have been differently applied in Scotland, which has caused some confusion, I think it's fair to say. We've obviously heard about the extension to the job retention scheme the Chancellor's announced, hoping for contributions from employers after the end of July for that scheme, as it's sort of unwound. We've been getting questions about whether there's options for Scotland here to do it, perhaps for longer if there's different measures in place. That has a lot of practical difficulties in terms of how it would be administered. And then obviously there's the issue about how it might be paid for, which is another difficult one given how expensive it is. There's the self-employment scheme at the UK level, which has been put in place to cover those who are on self-assessed tax. There's been an additional fund put in place in Scotland for those who are the newly self-employed, given that the self-employment scheme doesn't cover those who haven't been able to file a tax return in past years. So there is these additional schemes in place in Scotland to support these people. And then there's also a £350 million package for community and voluntary organisations, much of which is being used to boost local government kind of welfare and hardship funds in order to support people through this particular crisis. But there are still those who are falling through the cracks in support. There's those who are incorporated and directors of their own company, for example, who are still not getting any tailored support. And there's also, we're hearing quite patchy coverage for the third sector, where well-run charities with a decent amount of reserves are being denied support because it's felt that they're not in crisis. So that might be an issue which comes to the fore in the months to come when these organisations are trying to sort of rebuild communities and ensure that services are in place as the economy opens up again. But what next for the policy response, how we're getting out of lockdown? I think it's fair to say that the response continues to be a bit more cautious in Scotland. Obviously, some of the lockdown measures were eased in England in the last couple of weeks. We've heard from the First Minister yesterday that might happen from next Thursday in Scotland in a sort of similar fashion, I think, than what's happening in England on the social side, although there's less about how many people and what sort of sectors might be going back to work. As we've been saying, it's important that any return to work recognises the circumstances of different types of workers. There's the childcare implications. If the schools aren't back, how do people with children get back to work? There's obviously public transport. Workers in England have been told to avoid public transport where possible, but that isn't always possible. And the worry is that this sort of measure would impact those without access to a private car, who feel that they then have to take more risks than other people do. And then support for shielded groups. What do people need to shield? What are the sort of support packages that might be put in place for those who need to self-isolate or shield in order to continue to protect public health? And what we're finding is there are lots of ideas about reimagining the economy, but we need to see what the economy kind of looks like as it begins to emerge and recover. Quite a lot of these ideas are sort of how people would like to see the world rather than what might happen. So it's not just about what we want, but what might be feasible to introduce given the economic circumstances that we find ourselves in as we emerge out of this crisis. On the fiscal side, as Richard mentioned, a lot of attention now turning to the sort of fiscal cost of these measures, and the deficit ranges are quite large, but the figures are unprecedented even in the context of the financial crisis. So there is a discussion about the potential implications of this in the long term, about whether there'll be further austerity, whether there'll be tax rises, certainly be an acceptance of higher levels of government debt, which has been pointed out won't cost much more to service than cut the debt before the crisis. We're getting asked a lot about what this might mean for the Scottish budget and the fiscal framework that's in place between the Scottish and UK governments. Does it necessarily have to require more powers in a circumstance like this? And what choices could the Scottish government make about how to spend its budget? So to cover these issues, I'm going to hand over to David to talk about the implications for the Scottish budget.
Okay, thank you, Mary. Good morning, everyone. If you cast your minds back to the 6th of February, that seems like a very, very long time ago. It was when the Scottish budget for 2021 was set out, and the budget contained no mention of COVID-19 or coronavirus, which shows just how quickly this crisis came up on us. But it raises lots of interesting questions, of course, about where are these resources coming from to pay for the policy responses that Mary has talked about at a Scottish level. Does the Scottish government have enough flexibility in terms of that funding? And of course, in a world now where the Scottish budget is determined in part by Scottish income tax revenues and various other devolved taxes, what are the risks that the Scottish budget faces if those revenues come in lower than they were forecast to do, which they inevitably will do? So those are some of the questions I'll consider over the next few minutes. So in terms of the funding of the response, if we move on to the next slide, of course, most of the main elements of the economic response to COVID-19 have been applied by the UK government and apply UK-wide. So that includes the job retention scheme and the self-employment income support scheme and so on. But where policies apply to England only, where the UK government announces spending that applies to England only, the Scottish budget benefits from an increase in its block grant, a population share in the increase in its block grant. Now, since the Scottish budget was published at the beginning of February, the block grant has increased by around £3.6 billion. The Scottish government has chosen to allocate that additional £3.6 billion in a broadly similar pattern as has happened in England. So although there have been some differences in policy that Mary's touched on, the broad allocation of the funding of that £3.6 billion has followed the general pattern of down south. So a bulk of it, around £2.2 billion, reflects support for business through reliefs on non-domestic rates and grants to business. Around £600 million is additional funding to the health and social care in Scotland. And the rest split between transport and the welfare and wellbeing fund. Now, of course, one issue with the way the funding settlement works is that this Barnett formula takes no account of spending needs. It allocates increases to the Scottish block grant on the basis of Scotland receiving a per capita share of increases in spending in England. And there is some concern that, well, what happens if the spending needs required to deal with this crisis turn out to be somewhat higher in Scotland than in the rest of the UK, which is clearly a possibility. And it's worth noting that the Scottish government doesn't actually have any scope to increase its spending over and above the plans it set out in February, plus these additional consequentials that have flowed in the weeks and months since then. It can't borrow within year to fund discretionary increases in its spending. So if we move on to talk about some of the revenue risks, and first of all, income tax. Income tax was forecast to contribute just over £12 billion to the Scottish budget this year. Clearly, we would expect revenues are going to come in quite a bit less than that, although it's very difficult to know at the moment how much less. So what impact will that have on the Scottish budget and on spending plans in 2021? There are two key points to bear in mind here. The first is that there will be no impact of weaker Scottish income tax revenues this year on spending in 2021. The UK government bears all of the short-term revenue risk. And what happens in terms of the Scottish budget is we wait until we get outturn data in 2022, and then we have a reconciliation, a budget adjustment in 2023-24. So there's an extent to which that risk can be parked. And then the second point is that even when it comes to that reconciliation in 2023-24, the UK government bears the risk of UK-wide revenue shocks. So what does that mean? Let's say, for argument's sake, that Scottish income tax revenues come in 10% lower than was forecast. As long as rest of UK income tax revenues are also 10% lower than forecast, there is no impact on the Scottish budget. It's the UK government that bears the risk of those UK-wide shocks. But if tax revenues decline proportionately more in Scotland, if they say decline 10% in the UK but 12% in Scotland, the Scottish budget bears the risk of that differential impact. And that's actually not an insignificant risk. A difference of a couple of percentage points in the growth or in the decline of those revenues could easily amount to a couple of £100 million. And it's not difficult to imagine the circumstances that might generate that kind of outcome if, for example, weakness in the offshore sector impacts Scottish revenues proportionately more than our UK revenues, or if Scotland relaxes economic restrictions more gradually than happens in the rest of the UK. Now, in terms of some of the smaller taxes, the budgetary risks are clearly sort of lower in the sense that revenues are lower. The principle of these smaller taxes, LBTT and landfill tax, the principle of the way they work is the same as for income tax. So it's the UK government that bears the risks of UK-wide reductions in revenues. And the Scottish budget is exposed to Scottish specific falls, any difference between the rest of what happens in the rest of the UK and in Scotland. But the difference with income tax is on timing. So negative reconciliations, if those happen, will happen this financial year in autumn. And it's the same story with social security powers. In the budget this year, we had transfer of £3.5 billion worth of spending on social security. The financial responsibility of that transferred to the Scottish budget. And again, if spending turns out to increase proportionately more in Scotland this year than it has done in the rest of the UK, there is a budgetary impact there for the Scottish budget this year and for spending this year. Now, if those risks materialise, the Scottish government does have some scope to manage those through borrowing powers and through use of something called the Scotland Reserve, which is basically a sort of rainy day fund. But both of those tools are heavily constrained. The Scottish government has ability to borrow up to £300 million to address these forecast error issues. But in fact, this year has already drawn down about £200 million of that to deal with the income tax forecast error in respect of 17-18, which has just fed through into this year's budget. And there's not a great deal of leeway in the Scotland Reserve either. So where does that leave us? Well, I mean, in terms of so many areas of policy, COVID-19 has really thrown into quite sharp relief some of the limitations and challenges of the fiscal framework. But let's start with a couple of the positives. And the positives really are the speed with which additional funding flows to the Scottish budget, the flexibility that the Scottish government has around that, and the fact that the UK government is bearing the risk of the UK-wide fiscal shock, which is clearly substantial. The next questions, I mean, we know quite a lot about the new funding that's been announced since February. What we know less about so far is the extent to which the government might reprioritize some of the plans that it had announced in February. And we should find out more about that at the spring budget revision later this month. And then in autumn, we'll get a sense of whether some of these risks are emerging in terms of the forecast errors for the devolved, the smaller devolved taxes and the social security spending. And if those risks do materialise, the question will be to what extent the Scottish Government seeks additional flexibilities over the rules of those fiscal, over the rules of the fiscal framework, which might include, for example, temporary suspension of rules on borrowing limits, or maybe removal of some of the constraints in terms of how resources can be transferred from the capital budget to the resource budget. Then, of course, in terms of the, well, slightly longer term, but in fact, slightly longer term really means any time from now, in fact, we're moving into the recovery phase, and that will clearly raise some interesting questions around the extent to which there is a need for a different fiscal response in Scotland and the extent to which there is flexibility to deliver that. And it might also create some interesting issues around the mix of devolved, shared and reserved powers and how those work together as we kind of move into a world in which we're kind of seeing things like the job retention scheme be withdrawn, and which is something managed by the UK government, and a renewed emphasis on employability initiatives, for example, which are a devolved responsibility. So scope in all of that for some frictions and tensions to emerge in terms of how the fiscal framework operates and how the balance of existing powers works, which might feed into a debate around further fiscal powers that should be devolved, or how the balance of risks and risk management tools in the fiscal framework needs to evolve. And the final point is just to note that clearly over the longer term, this crisis will inevitably shape the way that resources are allocated in future Scottish budgets. We might find out a bit more about that when the government publishes its medium-term financial strategy later this year, having postponed it from May. And of course, we might find out more about that from the Scottish Party's manifestos, given that we're now less than a year away from the next Holyrood election. So there's lots of interesting implications and things to think about from a Scottish budget perspective. And I'll hand back now to Graham for the Q&A.
Great. Thank you very much, everyone, for that really insightful presentation. So we've got about 40 minutes or so for Q&A. And as James mentioned, if you could use the Q&A function on the bottom of the screen and type in your question. And as I mentioned, we'll see these questions, excuse me, and then I'll do my best to share the questions as they come in across a wider list of participants, but it gives us a chance to filter them. And also for me to try and group some questions together so we can try and get through as many as possible, because already we see a large number of questions coming in. So there's a really interesting specific question at the start. Maybe I can turn to you, Richard, about the outlook for the minimum wage and to what extent that might be impacted in the foreseeable future, and how much of a priority that will be in the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I think what's interesting in terms of the impact of the coronavirus shock on the labour market has been that so far, the adjustment seems to have mostly been in hours worked rather than in salaries. Wages seem to be sort of sticky where they are, but with the exception that for anybody on the furlough scheme, they're obviously now getting paid 80% of what they were previously being paid, up to a cap of £2,500 a month. So I think for the moment, there's no sign that the pressure is actually coming on the minimum wage or on wage levels. I think the issue is that people are working fewer hours than they probably would want. The figures that came out today from the ONS showed quite strikingly in the last week of March, average hours fell by 8.4 hours per week. So, you know, we lost one day a week of work across the economy in the last week of March, and that has probably become even more serious since. So the reduction seems to be coming in the quantity of work being done rather than what people are getting paid. One can imagine, looking ahead, there are going to be a lot of workers who want to work longer hours, but their employers basically haven't got things for them to do and turnover to actually cover payroll. I do think, however, there's an interesting sort of paradox that's now emerging within the UK's welfare system, which is that we have traditionally had a welfare system which provides sort of basic minimum levels of support for people in the form of universal credit and the minimum wage, rather than a sort of more continental style salary replacement kind of social insurance model, where the welfare system is designed to make sure that regardless of your level of income, you don't face a large income loss when you move from employment into unemployment. That's something which is more common in France, more common in the continent of Europe. We've now got sort of a mixture of these two things in the UK. We have the minimum wage and we have universal credit setting a floor on incomes, but also through the job retention scheme, we've said, well, look, nobody should lose more than 20% of their salary if they're temporarily out of work. How those two things are going to coexist going forward, I think, is a really big question for the future of the welfare state and whether we retain something that looks like the JRS for sort of future shocks to the UK economy, or whether we go back to the old system of basically just providing minimum levels of provision for people.
Yeah, and maybe I could ask you, David, a more general question about the outlook for inequality and poverty in that context. I mean, given your experience up here in Scotland and the Poverty and Inequality Commission, and just trying to think ahead from what Karen and Richard were talking about, the outlook for the economy, where do you see the risks around, you know, poverty and inequality? And is there a risk that this could widen significantly?
I mean, I think if you think about the crisis so far has really exposed some of the sort of pre-existing inequalities that existed on all kinds of dimensions. I mean, it's ironic that when it started, you know, some people seem to think that this might be a sort of an equalizing recession or health shock in the sense that the virus could potentially strike the rich as much as the poor. But of course, we've actually seen evidence that the virus itself is affecting the poor more than it affects the rich. And that reflects partly the nature of the jobs that people do, and the fact that people in better paid jobs are more likely to be able to work from home. Also that people on lower incomes are more likely to live in housing situations, which means that the virus spreads more rapidly. So even on that health dimension, this appears to be something that is very much increasing or shining a light on those existing inequalities of housing and on work security and on income. So, I mean, the challenge, of course, is how do we address those issues as we move into the recovery phase? And I mean, there are so many potential responses there. We could and perhaps should have a separate event on that. But of course, people will talk about, on the one hand, you know, needing at a macro level, running the economy hot, trying to make sure we create new jobs, get wage growth going again. There are clearly issues around how we address the low pay and poor conditions of particular sectors of key work like social care. There are questions about the security net and the inadequacy of that and how we address that. And none of those things are mutually exclusive. And of course there are many other areas that we'll need to address as well. But this is the big challenge, but also you know, a great deal of opportunity to use this crisis and this rupture to address some of the weaknesses in the economic model, if you like, that we've had and that have been really revealed through this crisis.
And there's quite a few questions coming in from people around the universal basic income in that context, which seems to become a bit of a kind of a go-to policy idea that people are at least floating. So when we come back to that, is one of the specific questions later on. But maybe I'll turn to you, Cara. You talked about, you know, where the economy is going and various things we're picking up in terms of, you know, the outlook, and talking about how the recovery might take a lot longer than at least maybe was thought initially, but also some of the other more kind of official forecasts. And there's a really good question there about the balance between potentially coming out of the lockdown too early or too late, and what the economic impact might be, and what the costs and benefits and trade-offs of coming out too early or coming out too late, and that, I guess, that kind of balancing act. So what's your take on that?
It's a really interesting question. And I guess the sort of straightforward answer, looking at kind of the charts I was showing you earlier, is that modelling a longer lockdown period becomes a lot more expensive, particularly as I showed you in terms of the policy costings as well as the economic impact. But it's obviously not as straightforward as that. And actually, when we were modelling scenarios we wanted to present, I think it's probably more likely that you'd see this 12-month scenario as a kind of a loosening of restrictions than a reimposing if there's a virus spike. It's not necessarily, you'd probably be more likely to see it as a loosening and then a reimposing than just a 12 months of pure lockdown. So there is also, you could end up in that longer scenario if there was a loosening too early. So that balancing act is going to prove really difficult. I think in terms of the health side, that's obviously something that we're definitely not experts on. But on the economic side, trying to strike that balance might end up looking a bit more like some of the things Richard was talking about in terms of how to support companies to safely go back to operating, people to safely get back to work. But it is going to be a very difficult balance to strike, trying to make sure we don't end up in those 12-month sort of scenarios.
Yeah, and one of the things that builds on that, I guess, turn to you, Mary, around the Scottish context and all of this, is how Scotland might differ. You touched on this already, but how Scotland might differ from the rest of the UK, both in sector mix. We've also seen that in past recessions as well, where Scotland's tended to have a slightly less deep recession, perhaps because of a larger public sector, but then the recovery is less strong. And so there's a couple of people asking, you can say a wee bit more, A, about the potential risks and where Scotland might diverge, but where also might be some opportunities for Scotland's economy in all of this.
Yeah, I mean, the most obvious example of a difference in a sector which could mean that the overall impact on Scotland would be more severe is the oil and gas sector, because we saw in 2015-16 with the oil price shock how much that impacted on the onshore economy in Scotland. And we saw a significant divergence between growth in Scotland and the UK at that point in time, which has never really been recovered. So, you know, there's definite precedent for a severe shock in the oil and gas sector to significantly impact on different parts of the Scottish economy. There's a lot of different sectors who rely on a successful offshore Scotland to operate and to be profitable. The other aspect, the other main aspect, is about social and hospitality, tourism related spending. It does make up a bigger proportion of the economy in Scotland than the UK as a whole, and particularly it's important for rural areas of Scotland, the Highlands and Islands, for example, where it makes up a significant part of the economy. And many of these operators are small businesses. There's the high levels of self-employment. So these sorts of businesses tend to be less resilient to economic shocks as well. So there's a lot of worry in these areas of Scotland, how they sort of might recover from that. In addition, there's obviously the things we're hearing from businesses in Scotland who aren't operating during the crisis, whereas similar businesses in the rest of the UK are operating. And as I said, the most obvious example of that was in construction. So these are the sorts of differences we're seeing about both sectoral makeup and possible differences in applying guidance. And as you see, whilst there is a bigger public sector in Scotland in terms of driving growth in the future, and you know what the sort of medium-term impact might be on the Scottish economy, on balance, I think we would come down on the side that there may be a more severe impact on Scotland than the UK as a whole, just because of these sectoral differences. In terms of the opportunities, you know, there's been a lot of questions about whether, you know, more people will travel within the UK in the future. Perhaps there's opportunities there to tap into that market. I mean, one of the things I'd say is that international visitors tend to spend more money, tend to stay longer, so it does tend to be a more lucrative form of tourism for Scotland. But there may be other opportunities as businesses look at their supply chains and perhaps put more emphasis on local supply chains and, you know, de-risking where they're getting their products from in order to ensure supplies. So it may be that there is some opportunities there for businesses who come through the crisis successfully.
Thank you. And Richard, turning to you about, I guess we've spoken a lot about fiscal policy and all of this, and obviously monetary policy is constrained quite significantly by how low interest rates were at the start of all of this. But I guess the bit that sits in between the middle of that is quantitative easing, and how might that be used to try and either boost spending or do things innovatively around some of the projects or infrastructure or whole aspects of sort of rethinking of quantitative easing. Do you think that's a viable option and something that we should look at, and particularly in the more in the recovery phase, to use quantitative easing more aggressively?
Yeah, I think central banks have certainly been as innovative as finance ministries have been over the last few weeks in terms of the response to the crisis. I think, and as you say, interest rates are obviously now at rock bottom. It's very hard, unless you're willing to contemplate negative interest rate territory, to do very much more with that as an instrument. They have ramped up quantitative easing again, as they did in the wake of the financial crisis. I think there are probably also limits, however, to how much just an expansion of pure QE is going to do to consumption spending, partly because consumption is, again, artificially constrained by the fact that it's difficult to go out to the shops and spend money, to go into restaurants, spend money on holidays, those sorts of things. So just putting the money into the hands of consumers might lead to a lot of it being saved in banks rather than actually spent in the economy. But it's clear, at least at the moment and in the near term, a lot of what the Bank of England is doing is actually supporting the government's ability to borrow on the secondary market. So they are sitting there in the secondary market, meaning that whenever banks buy government debt, they can on-sell it to the Bank of England quite quickly. And that makes the debt much more liquid, much more easy to turn into cash, and makes it more attractive to people who are interested in lending their money to the government. So I think what the Bank of England is doing at the moment is sort of facilitating fiscal policies intervention to support economic activity through CBILS, through the job retention scheme. There are other central banks that have gone even further. The Federal Reserve is actually going out there and buying sort of risky debt in the economy, and actually directly supporting firms with their payroll costs. And that is really unprecedented territory for central banks and advanced economies to be getting into. So central banks lending directly into the real economy. But that is something which was seen as necessary in the US, but is obviously proven controversial, because people worry about that being the road to pure monetization and sort of fiscal dominance of monetary policy, kind of hyperinflation and everything else. I think that's a long way off, but at the very least, central banks are in very new and different territory than they were a few years ago. And that has implications for how you think about the management of those interventions. I think one thing to say about the sort of Scottish angle on all of this is that, from the point of view of Scotland, the more economic support being provided to the economy is coming through the Bank of England, the less benefit that has to the Scottish budget, right? If the Bank of England is doing more through its own lending facilities to provide support to the economy, that means that it's not being done through fiscal policy. If it's done through fiscal policy, that means government expenditure is higher and there are higher barnet consequentials for Scotland. So I think from a Scottish point of view, there's a real fiscal advantage to this, to interventions being done through traditional fiscal policy instruments, perhaps higher government spending, perhaps supported by the Bank of England, to allow the government to do the borrowing. The more it's done through central banks, the more it's sort of off the books from the point of view of the Scottish fiscal framework and the Barnett formula. And that potentially poses, you know, a bigger challenge for Scotland, because you can't actually mirror the level of support being provided UK-wide through your own budget.
And this kind of started to bubble up a bit last week, Mary, when there was a discussion about the Scottish government issuing long-term bonds to fund a whole manner of different things, from universities through to third sector. And obviously, I'll make turn to Cara in a second about how we start to think about paying all of this back. But and particularly in Scotland, the debate about being able to issue bonds and use that to invest and support the recovery. Could you give us some reflections on that? I know you were at Finance and Economy Committee being asked this question in the last couple of days, so good to get your reflections on that.
Yeah, I mean, under the Scotland Act 2016, the Scottish Government does have the ability to issue bonds, but it's worth saying that that is subject to the current capital limits that exist on borrowing. So in terms of the mechanisms for borrowing, it makes more sense for the Scottish Government just to borrow from the Treasury directly. Obviously, some of the suggestions have been whether the Scottish Government could benefit from the sorts of low interest rates that the Treasury can issue bonds at, because it would be a lot less expensive to do it that way. But I think the wider question is really about whether that's the thing we should be talking about right now. Does it necessarily mean that more powers or more borrowing powers are necessary for the Scottish Government to manage this crisis? Particularly in the short term, David's talked about some potential flexibilities that could be negotiated between the governments on capital to resource switching, or simply relaxation of limits for managing the current crisis, rather than that necessarily being baked in long-term fiscal framework. I think we've seen from the fiscal framework that the current borrowing limits aren't sufficient to deal with the level of risk that the Scottish budget will have itself exposed to in normal times, never mind at a time like this. But I think there is a question for the Scottish Government about what it's doing with the budget it has, and whether there are some bold choices it can make to invest in the economy to support it through the recovery. Yes, it might mean stopping doing some things and reprioritising, but it does have a significant budget at its disposal, and therefore, just like the UK government's been quite bold with a lot of the policy measures it's brought forward to support the economy through the crisis, it might be that the Scottish government has to do the same.
Yeah, and if I could talk to you, Cara, about you talked a bit about, you know, the likely impact on borrowing and debt, and Richard said it was kind of manageable at the current time. There's still demand for government gilts, etc. But I guess one of the things that we know at the end of this, there's going to be quite a hefty debt stock now on the public sector balance sheet in all of this. So one of the really good questions here is what's the plan for that, and what's the and how might there be intergenerational, you know, implications for inheriting a significant stock of debt, and how we might try and think about unwinding that.
Yeah,
any reflections on that?
Yeah, really interesting question. I guess the first kind of point on this is what Richard sort of touched on in terms of our focus at the moment is going to really have to be on the recovery. And actually, given that we think there is kind of a little bit of fiscal room, or that debt appears, while very high, relatively sustainable in the short term, our focus should be on the recovery rather than the kind of consolidating and bringing that debt down too quickly. But you're right that there is already kind of a lot of talk about how we are going to start bringing debt down. It's interesting looking back over kind of history and looking at how in previous recessions government debt has been brought back down, and particularly what options are kind of available for us now. Post-war, a lot of that work was done by kind of the macroeconomic environment, so growth and inflation were unlikely to be in that kind of environment after this crisis. I guess also we've seen previously like asset sales in the 80s or financial asset sales after the financial crisis brought debt down. We're not kind of in a position to be doing that. So it's probably going to be a more traditional look at either kind of cuts to spending or rising taxes coming out of 10 years of austerity. And the effect on public sector and public spending would be hoping that there would be more of that burden taken on by tax rises. I guess one thing interesting is a few of the questions mention a kind of a green economy going forward, and there might be opportunities there for green taxes. But yeah, that's going to be big choices for the government in the coming months.
Yeah, and it gets into really interesting questions about manifesto commitments and what was signed up to before all of this, and does that start to influence and change any decision making, or is it actually all bets are off and we start again in all of this? I mean, just a particular question that's come up, and either to yourself or Richard, around mentioning how, if you take something like the job retention scheme, about encouraging greater flexibility for people to move around, so sectors that might be under particular pressure take time to come back. So what sectors do you see as potentially being ones that may be able to take up some more of the slack? So which ones might be in the front end of the recovery that potentially that you could see as looking to try and prioritise and support to mop up some of this excess employment?
Yeah, I'm happy to have a go at that. I think there is certainly a need to try to facilitate labour mobility, especially as part of the issue at the moment is actually government policy is inhibiting labour mobility because of the way the CJRS scheme works. The principle of employment support in other countries has always been that you should support the worker, not the job. And that if you end up supporting jobs, you end up subsidising kind of industries in long-term decline rather than actually providing income support to the employee, but also things like retraining, which allows them to move from one sector, a sector in decline, to a sector that might be recovering. I mean, certainly sectors that are able to sort of move online, function at a distance, are those which are doing well. Kind of more prosaically, sort of Tesco's is still hiring. And anybody in the delivery business is actually probably operating beyond capacity at the moment. And you're seeing hiring growing in those sorts of sectors. That's probably, however, going to be temporary, and at least not be able to absorb the entire increase in worklessness that you've seen in the wake of the downturn. I would caution, however, against thinking too sectorally in thinking about the way in which we, if we're thinking about providing differential support to different groups of people, because it's not just about the sector that you work in, it is also about your ability to actually leave your home and go to work. And that comes back to issues around having vulnerable people in your household, whether you have access to childcare. And there may be people who work in sectors where you can reopen a manufacturing, a factory and work at a social distance. But if they can't get access to childcare, or if they've got somebody at home who's vulnerable, they can't go to work that day. And so they may well need support, continuing support in that sector, even if in principle, that's a sector which can operate at full capacity in the context of social distance.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I think one of the things that we've been chatting about is how do you, when you start to unwind this, not inadvertently build in aspects that will increase inequalities or disadvantage people more than others. So, if you're able to start operating at a relatively lower level of operations and you're encouraging some people back to work, it's the people who don't have access to childcare or maybe have caring responsibilities or who have to rely on public transport and who would have faced much greater hurdles in getting back to work. But the people who don't have these responsibilities or who have private transport or live close to the work, they're going to be first in the queue. And there's a slight risk about just not trying to get things back up, without thinking through the potential unintended consequences of all of this, which I think is a really quite significant risk. So maybe if we can turn for the last 15 minutes or so to talk about the future and touch wood once we get out of this, and what the future might look like. And there's quite a few questions around reimagining our economy, building a different type of model. Carrie, you touched on already a bit about like the green recovery and what that might look like. So maybe try and divide up some of the questions into some relatively high level questions about, broadly speaking, what do you see as being the opportunities to develop a new type of model, and what are the potential barriers to that and context? And then also maybe pick up on a couple of specifics around, a few people have mentioned basic income and changes to taxation and aspects there. So maybe if I could maybe just as an open question to the panel around, What do you see as being the opportunities to reimagine the economy in that context? So maybe, Carrie, you mentioned about the green economy. So maybe if you can explain a wee bit more about that, and then I'll be able to open up more generally to Mary, Richard and David around the whole idea of a well-being economy or economy that focuses more on tackling inequalities. Maybe, Carrie, if you could kick us off with the green aspect.
Well, I guess it's important not to sort of overstate. It's going to be a very difficult kind of economic time to be kind of trying to reinvent economic models. But I think there are some opportunities, particularly if the government's looking to increase taxes, bring down debt burdens, in kind of more green taxation. And also, I think Richard mentioned a bit about kind of infrastructure spending as in part of the recovery phase, and some of that might be best focused on kind of green innovation and green infrastructure. And that could be an opportunity coming out of this, but again, very uncertain.
Okay, and Richard, Mary and David, more general, you know, reimagining what a new, better future could look like. Where do you see the priorities as lying? And I guess what do you see as the opportunities, but also the challenges in moving to that, that new future?
Shall I?
You should go first, David.
In some ways, this crisis has been like most of the previous economic crises that we've seen, in the sense that at the start of it, you get this flurry of commentary about how things can and should be different as a result. Of course, in most of the recent recessions we've seen, we haven't actually come out of the recession, of the crisis, to a particularly different sort of economic model or fiscal structure. There's a case for saying, of course, that the sheer scale of this crisis means that this time should be different. There's some truth in that, I think. But on the other hand, there is this point that Cara was making, that actually, you know, at the moment we're still in the depths of the crisis, and the bandwidth of governments and public sector generally to think about paradigmatic shifts in how we do things is very limited. And of course, once we get out of the crisis, then maybe some of that impetus will go. So maybe there's actually quite a small kind of window of opportunity to make some of this stuff happen. But clearly there are some, you know, this crisis is going to raise some big questions and challenges around how and in what ways the public sector raises revenues. And, you know, there are all kinds of things there to look at in terms of the potential for wealth taxes and so on, but also in terms of things like social security system and the social safety nets and how the opportunities that there are to take that forward. But I mean, there's no I don't have a kind of crystal ball to know what is going to happen, and nothing is guaranteed, of course, but the opportunity to have these sort of discussions and debates is possibly the kind of the silver lining of this crisis.
Yeah, and Richard, if I come to you, I mean, obviously the Resolution Foundation has at its heart the focus on trying to deliver better outcomes for those in low and middle incomes. And I mean, how do you see this crisis potentially, you know, changing the model that we have, and whether that's beneficial or the risks for those in low and middle incomes?
Yeah, I think one thing that it's revealed is that we have underinvested in public health, and that's, I think, a very narrow answer to this crisis. But we have not invested in the kind of resilience that we need to ensure that we can actually manage these kind of pandemics. I think other countries which have fresher memories of things like SARS and MERS in East Asia, I think, have been better at managing both the initial impact of the crisis, but also setting up things like testing and tracing arrangements. And so I think there is learning about the value of investing in things like public health, which are actually turn out to be critical to the resilience of your economy as a whole, not just the health of the population. So I think learning a bit more about those and making sure that we learn from this crisis is important. I think more broadly, there is, I think, both a challenge and an opportunity related to younger people and people who are just coming out of education, either as school leavers or people who are leaving further or higher education, who are going to be coming into a very tough labor market. in the next few months. And I think there is a big question about whether we as an economy invest enough in this, in the skills of our people, and whether we can actually use an opportunity of a disrupted labor market to actually do a big investment in skills. There are a lot of people who are spending an awful lot of time at home these days, you know, not working. They could be using that time to actually be upskilling. A lot of us have had to learn to use things like Zoom, teleconferencing, remote working, and those sorts of things. And so there's that's been a sort of necessary upskilling, either if you want to work or if you want to be able to see your grandchildren on a regular basis. And so I think there is an opportunity, I think, to use the fact that people have a bit more downtime at the moment to actually upskill them in areas so that when they do go back into the workforce, they're more productive, they're higher earning than you've traditionally seen in the UK, which has been a sort of, you know, low-skilled, low-productivity economy. And maybe we can actually move it you know, through taking advantage of the fact that people have got time for training to incentivize it to happen, and when they re-enter the workforce, actually be operating at a higher level of productivity.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I mean, related to that, there's been a bit of debate developed up here in recent times in Scotland about arguing that the focus should be less on growth and more on something else, and the broad term for that being well-being or some other terminology. So it'd be really interesting to get your reflections on, you know, in this recovery and this ability to tackle inequalities and support people, what you see as a role for growth in that. So, you know, can we essentially help to rebuild the economy successfully with very little growth? Is that something we should be worried about, or is it something that actually we should be focused on other aspects? And it's quite, because it's quite an interesting debate up here now about, you know, this, what is the role of growth in this context?
I think, I mean, from my side, and in particular, looking at some of the, you know, some of the fiscal figures, and coming back to the question about how do you reduce levels of debt, you do need some growth, and so I don't think governments can turn their back on growth when they're going to be leaving this crisis with the level of debt that that we are likely to have. And I think, as Cara was saying, there are, you know, there were options that were available to governments in the wake of the post-war years, you know, things like high levels of inflation or holding interest rates down. That helped governments to actually inflate away their debt. Those options aren't really available to us if we want to actually, you know, reduce our fiscal vulnerability coming out of this crisis. So we are going to need some growth and some tax revenues to make the fiscal position sustainable as we exit it. But that growth, you know, doesn't need, you know, could be greener than the growth that we've had in the past. It can be more inclusive than the growth that we've had in the past. But I don't think you can just turn your back on economic growth and say that it's no longer a priority, because As a government and as taxpayers, you know, we're going to get a hefty bill from this crisis at the end of it, and we're going to have to pay it.
Yeah, that's really important. And so, one of the specific things that's dominated, or at least risen to quite attention in this debate, is how we might change the social security system or the tax system more. More significantly than we've done in the past. And the one that keeps jumping up the agenda is the idea of a basic income and what that might look like. And again, that's something that's kind of risen to attention here in Scotland. So maybe if I could turn to you first, David, to get your reflections on just the kind of basic income debate. And maybe, Richard, it'd be good to get your reflections on that as well.
Again, the crisis is one of these things that has really reinvigorated the debate around basic income. And it's interesting to think about whether the economy would have been more resilient, or the extent to which the economy might have been more resilient to this crisis if we'd had a basic income. And of course, if we'd had a basic income, if the government had been paying a basic income universally to all adults, then when this crisis hit, we wouldn't have had to, you know, have this administrative crisis of trying to administer huge additional claims to universal credit, which, as well as being an administrative challenge, is of course very stressful for the individuals that are having to make those claims and are, you know, uncertain about what the outcome of the claim might be or when they might receive income. So from that sense, you know, that's I guess one of the key reasons why people are talking about more about a universal basic income is in terms of improving the resilience to these sorts of shocks in future. Of course, a universal basic income might not have actually negated the need for us to have something like the job retention scheme anyway, because the point of the job retention scheme is to keep employees attached to their employers and therefore, in theory, sort of help the recovery when that comes, help the recovery to come more quickly. Although there's also a danger that if you don't make the adjustments to the job retention scheme in the right way, then potentially a basic income would be just as good at supporting that recovery as a job retention scheme. Those are the sort of ways in which the crisis sort of shifts the perspective. Of course, it doesn't really get around what have always been some of the big challenges for the basic income debate, and that is that whenever people look at this question, if you have a basic income that is remotely meaningful, it becomes incredibly difficult to fund. That's true at a UK level. It's one thing to say, well, we shouldn't worry too much about a temporary increase in debt as a response to this crisis, but that doesn't mean you can sort of increase debt indefinitely by having a very generous CBI scheme. And it's even more challenging to see how it could be funded at a Scotland specific level, given the current distribution of fiscal powers, because I don't think it's realistic to think that it could be funded through the existing fiscal powers, and probably not even if you did something quite bold in terms of setting up new wealth taxes and so on in Scotland. So definitely a good debate to continue to have.
Yeah, and Richard, you're taking the basic income debate, and I guess the strengths and weaknesses in that.
Yeah, so I think I agree with David that the challenge with UBI is as soon as it becomes provides a sort of meaningful level of support to large groups of the population, it does become very expensive. Our revealed preference, it seems, in the wake of the coronavirus outbreak is that we want to provide people with some kind of income insurance so that when they are temporarily workless, they don't face big drops in their income. But we're funding that through borrowing, right? You saw the numbers in those that Cara presented. If you want a universal basic income scheme, which provides that level of support for everybody in perpetuity, countries that provide much more generous levels of basic social security provision pay much higher levels of tax. And if they have these kind of social insurance type welfare systems, they pay much higher levels of social and social contributions. And those also have implications for things like labor participation, because it just increases the cost of employing individuals if those insurance contributions are then tied to their benefits. So I don't think it's not a costless proposition. I think the other thing to say is that part of the intention of the job retention scheme was to stop people seeing big drops in their income, because that would have seen a bigger contraction in consumption and a bigger contraction in economic activity, and potentially defaults on mortgages, defaults on rent payments, and a sort of cascading consequences throughout the economy. If you had a low level of UBI, it wouldn't actually help with that problem, because you'd see a lot of people falling from relatively high levels of income down onto the UBI floor, and you'd still see those kind of knock-on consequences for the rest of the economy. So it's a solution designed to solve a slightly different problem than things like the JRS. And the JRS is designed to be basically a temporary scheme, you know, for this particular shock. What it evolves into, I think, is a really interesting question, and I'm not sure I know the answer yet, but it's something which we will be keeping an eye on.
Yeah, and I guess that's the thing. What's quite interesting is what I think the basic income debate is helping to do is to potentially open up what other options might be available, and what's the question you're trying to answer, and what mechanism comes in there. And Mary, I guess you're starting to think about what the alternative options might be around all of that.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's important not to mix up which policy responses might be appropriate for ensuring a minimum level of income that we think the state should provide so people can live a dignified standard of living, and measures which may support people to transition from certain types of work to other types of work as the economy changes, technology changes, and so on. And quite often when people think about basic income, they're sort of mixing up the two. And we do need to think about what we're trying to achieve by introducing a basic income. Is it about poverty, and is it about ensuring a minimum level of income, or is it about ensuring that people's level of income can be maintained if they find themselves on unemployment, in order to continue to support the economy, to continue to pay their mortgage, continue to pay their rent as they find their way into new work? And it is important that these sorts of different sorts of schemes of job insurance, minimum income, aren't sort of mixed up, because they do have kind of different policy objectives and may have different outcomes for the population. And just to say for the attendees, we will be doing quite a bit more work on this in the coming weeks about the different alternatives we could look at in terms of job insurance or even job guarantee schemes and other things that are being proposed by some trade unions, for example. So we'll be doing a lot more work on this, so look out for that.
Great, and thank you very much, Mary. I am conscious that it's 1 minute to 11, and it's supposedly good Zoom etiquette to not run over the time that you've been allocated. So I'm sorry we haven't been able to get around all of the questions today, and the questions have been excellent, and we've really enjoyed this session. I think one of the things this shows to me is that there's lots of demand for potentially a follow-up session. It'd be really good to do this again and to answer some of the questions we unfortunately didn't get around to in this session. Before we close, could I just take this opportunity to thank you for joining us? And thank you for the ongoing support that you're giving both to ourselves at Fraser Island Institute and also the work at the Resolution Foundation too. I could also just thank Mary, Richard, David and Cara for joining me today and giving us such an interesting session and being so open on the questions. Thank you very much again for joining us. Stay safe, and we look forward to seeing you all very, very soon. Thank you very much.